by spoof weekends through July 17th. For tickets, visit racinetheater.org or call 633-4218.
Support comes from the Racine Symphony, celebrating its 85th season with its annual gala at Wingspread, Saturday, August 6th. It's an evening of music, elegant hors d'oeuvres, and beverages against the serene backdrop of the Wingspread landscape. To reserve a seat or a table, call 636-9285.
Support for WGTD comes from Andrea's, proudly serving our Kenosha community since 1911. Visit our cafe for homemade soups, salads, and sandwiches. Go to andreasgifts.com to find out today's specials.
This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, Chuck Wolbers, a special education teacher with Kenosha Unified Successful Transitions for Exceptional Students Program, and Steve Brown, assistant professor of educational leadership at UW Oshkosh. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Steve Brown, welcoming you into this edition of Education Matters here on WGTD HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. My guests this morning are Jennifer Charpentier, the executive director of the Gateway Technical College Foundation, and also Christina Samuels, a staff writer for Education Week, and she specializes in the area of special education. And I'm very pleased to have in our studio this morning Dr. Jennifer Charpentier, and she is the executive director of the Gateway Foundation, and welcome back to Education Matters.
Thanks for having me back.
I always like to first let our audience know a bit about the guest that I have on Education Matters, and maybe if you could tell us a little about your own educational background.
Sure. So I was very fortunate to earn a bachelor's in political science from Carleton College, located in Northfield, Minnesota. And while I was there, I uncovered an interest in understanding about messages and my bachelor's is in political science. And after going to work for 10 years for the Girl Scouts in St. Paul, after I graduated, I decided I wanted to pursue more education. And I pursued a master's and a PhD in communication studies from the University of Minnesota. And my research was in the area of messages and looking at the effects of messages and social influence processes. So I have the theoretical background for my daily practice, which is wonderful.
When you talk about messages, obviously there's always a message in everything and anything we read or hear. But as someone who has studied messages from both a theoretical and a practical point of view, as you look at whether it's a political campaign or a branding campaign of a product, what's the one thing that you think sometimes whomever is heading up the message misses?
You know, I think it's always how is it going to resonate for the audience and the people you're trying to connect with, and speaking in a language that connects with them, and also looking at what matters to them and their values and how they see themselves and how either they want to be or how they see themselves and what they like about themselves right now. And so I think we always need to be thinking about how are we connecting with our audience. And I think often there's good work that gets done, so that's exciting. Certainly all of us have areas we can improve as well.
So as we look now at the Gateway Foundation, which was actually created back in 1977, when you go out and you talk to people, what are some of the primary messages that you want people to know about with respect to the foundation?
So one of the things I think is really important for people to know is the impact that they are having in our students' lives and in the community. I mean, when I think about our students' stories and how they talk about how I couldn't have been in school this semester, I might not have been able to finish this semester because of the scholarship they received. When we think about how critical education is for our community and for growth in our community, knowing that a student's life and their family's lives have been changed through a gift is extraordinary. And whether it's through the student emergency funds or our scholarships or helping somebody with GED testing, You know, there's a wide variety of ways that people help either close an immediate gap for a student to be able to stay and succeed in school, or over the long term, helping to provide really excellent opportunities here in education through our inspiration grants, or also helping for, sometimes folks are helping with the capital projects we have on campus, and that sometimes in order to provide the wonderful lab experiences that we want to provide for our students or student experiences, sometimes that takes some private philanthropic support, and all of that comes together in terms of what a student experiences here at Gateway.
You talked about the emergency grants, the student emergency funds for our students. Give us an example, without mentioning any names, of course, about a recent emergency, if you will, where a student put in a request, and maybe also talk about the process. So if someone is listening to this program, and either they themselves might be a student here, or they might know of someone who needs some help.
The student emergency funds, we actually exhausted our funds earlier in the year and now have just recently opened them up. So when that happened, we have a certain amount that we have to keep going because we received a very generous gift from the Howard Brown Estate. And as folks may know, he was publisher of the Kenosha News, among many, many other things, and a wonderful community citizen.
And he was also a member of the 91.1 Players for our WGTD Radio Theater.
Oh, he was. That's fantastic.
Yeah, he was a wonderful man.
So one of the things that Mr. Brown's estate did, or he planned for, was to make a gift to the foundation for our students, and those funds have been used, invested in over time in our endowment. So we always make sure we have some money available for student emergency funds. So so there's some of that investment, and then we have others in the community who give on an ongoing basis to help our student scholarship funds. So the emergency funds. So the emergency funds are really intended for a one-time, unanticipated, unexpected expense that could derail a student from staying here at Gateway. So one example that we give is a student who perhaps he's enrolled in our culinary program on the Racine campus, and he lives in Lake Geneva. Well, his car breaks down, and most of our students are living on the edge financially. He doesn't have the resources to get it repaired immediately. We know no public transportation exists between Lake Geneva and the Racine campus. And so what the student emergency funds can do is to help step in and to close the gap that he needs to have help closed on the car repair. So what his process would be, or her process, if they're looking at applying for student emergency funds, is the first thing they need to think about is to go have a conversation with one of our support counselors, either on the Racine, Kenosha, or Elkhorn campus, and to talk with the support counselor about the life barriers they're facing. So what happened to have this situation occur? And then based on that conversation, the counselor will talk through with them resources that we have in the community, whether it's a 501c3 organization that's providing great social service in our community, or if it's maybe some other problem solving that they hadn't done before. The counselor will talk through with them different problem solving techniques. One of the potential solutions may be accessing the student emergency funds. So if this counselor it's clear to them that's one of the things that they need to do to help solve this problem, the student fills out basically an application where they're asked about what's going on, what happened, and then that application is forwarded to our office, and my team takes a look at it to assess whether what they describe is the need that we can help fulfill, because there are some things that the emergency funds will fund and some things that they won't. Once the student has been approved for the emergency funds, then they are on the back end of their emergency funds process. They are alerted to what they have been granted, up to $500, and then the student comes in again to the campus or speaks with one of our student finance specialists to talk about, here's what your next steps are. We need to have you complete some paperwork. We strongly encourage to have the student write a handwritten thank you note for the donation that they've received or the grant that they have received, and then the student finance specialist will also enroll them in a program at the college called SALT, and that's capital S, capital A, capital L, capital T. And it's a financial literacy program that the college uses. It's available actually to any of our students and our alumni for their lifetime. It's really about helping, how do we help build good financial literacy skills? So hopefully at the end of this process, and once the emergency has passed, the student will have more skills to be able to deal with the next situation that they have come in front of them.
As we look at the foundation itself, maybe if we could start at the 40,000-foot level, and maybe if you could just talk briefly about what the vision of the foundation is, and then really the bottom line, you know, why do we even need a foundation mm-hmm. here at Gateway?
Sure. The 40,000-foot view and why do we need a foundation here at the college is that the foundation is a 501c3, meaning that we are considered to be a charitable organization. So for individuals and businesses who are looking to make a gift to charity that they know will go towards help someone at Gateway, then we are their best fit. So the foundation supports the mission of the college by raising community awareness and financial resources, building its base of support, and providing programs such as scholarships, grants, and funds for educational growth. So really the foundation's goal is to enhance the college's tradition of excellence by being responsive to its needs and strengthening the vitality and well-being of our communities.
As we look at all the different kinds of programs that go on during the year, what's a current program that is going on or an event, and then maybe we can talk about that, and then what the future looks like for the foundation.
Sure. So right now, actually, we have one of our scholarship application periods is open. That's our new adult learner scholarship timeframe or scholarship application. And our scholarships, what we title them, are based really on what the student's relationship is with the college and where they are in their educational trajectory. So for our new adult learners, the scholarship application will be open until August 7th. It is with all our scholarships, it's a one-time application done online. And based on what the applicant or the student, prospective student or current student, tells us about themselves, they get matched to the criteria of our scholarships. So the new adult learner scholarship is really for adults who, you know, they're a few years out of high school. That few years could be one or it could be, you know, 25. Mm-hmm. But they're coming here to Gateway to build their skills and to earn a credential, whether it's a technical diploma or a associate's degree. That scholarship is not based on your high school GPA, because all of us know it may have been some time since the last time you were there at high school. So really it's looking for students who have applied by July 1st and been accepted into their programs. So, and those scholarships are at least $500 apiece. Mm-hmm.
One of the other grants that we have here at the college through the foundation are the inspiration mm-hmm. grants. And I always love the name.
Yeah.
First of all, what is the message of the inspiration grants? And maybe if you could talk about what those are actually like.
I think it's a great title, too. I did not come up with it, but it's one we inherited. And really, the intention is to bring something innovative or to try something new here at the college. And it's for students, faculty, or staff to try something new, to bring something new to the classroom or to the campus, and to give it a go and see what it was like. Sometimes they're one-time projects, and sometimes it might be the start of additional conversation at the college. So the grants are up to $3,000, and we actually just completed our awarding of this year's Inspiration Grant recipients. And they range from helping the library to purchase large print and Spanish edition of the of True Grit, which is the Big Read, the mm-hmm. NEA Big Read, which the college is helping to is the host this year. Or it can be something that could potentially be it's let's give this a try. So another program that or grant that was awarded was one for students who were talking about really closing small gaps at their beginnings. And those beginnings might be they can't afford the test, the placement test. They can't afford whatever that $25 or $40 test is in order to get placed. Or in some of our programs, they require a background check, and the student can't afford the cost of the background check. Or in some cases, the student might not be able to afford to pay for graduation and the fee that goes with graduation. Mm-hmm. So we're really looking at making these small grants to help students get started, whether it's get started here at the college or to take that final step in their new beginning. So those are examples of a couple ones that have been recent or we just awarded. Another one that we did was we helped fund the gourmet mushroom stand at the urban farm with our horticulture program. So for listeners who get a chance to go to the urban farm, and if you see the gourmet mushroom stand there, then you know that your inspiration grant helped fund the starting for that.
As you look at, let's say, the next 3 years, you've been executive director now for 4 years. You're now starting your fifth year. What do you see into the future, say, over the next 3 years?
Sure. So this last year has really been one where we've been building infrastructure in the foundation. So we've just converted to a new database to help us really better manage our relationships with our donors. We actually also just, the college just transferred the alumni information from the last 25 years so that we can continue to help build that relationship with our alumni, let our alums know that the college is here for you, whether it's through networking opportunities or just social events, or reconnecting with the college for career pathing or for looking for jobs. The college is still here for you. And so we're in the process of reconnecting with alumni and offering alumni events. So I'd imagine in 3 years, those will be more robust than what they are today. Our foundation board just engaged in some strategic planning for the first time in many years. And so they are in the process of looking at what are our priorities in terms of how we can help the college and help our students. Mm-hmm. So I would anticipate that we will have more volunteers engaged with the foundation, and whether that's reading scholarship applications or serving on the foundation board or on board committees. It takes many skills and many passions to help really move our organization forward and help provide the best that we can for the college.
Jennifer, I've read a bit about the Gateway Promise, and maybe if you could just share briefly what that's all about.
Well, Steve, the Gateway Promise is really an extraordinary opportunity and a promise that Gateway is making to the community about providing access to college education. And our intent really is to change the conversations at dining room tables and at conference tables about families thinking about their child being able to go to college. And so the promise is for students who meet certain financial eligibility requirements and also certain academic eligibility requirements. And those, so for the promise, our first class of students will be the fall of 2017. And so they are our students this summer who are looking towards their senior year of high school. Mm. And the goal is that we are looking for students who need the gap closed for them so that they can persist here at the college. So in addition to providing college tuition free, the other piece of it are some critical wraparound services. They are services that the college provides to any of our students, but the Gateway Promise students will be required to participate in mm-hmm. in workshops, in academic preparation, in getting engaged in the college through student groups and a variety of other experiences. Because we know from our experience that students who have these experiences persist when they're here at Gateway. Mm-hmm. The other unique feature of the Gateway Promise is that it is it's a commitment of 6 semesters of school rather than just 4 semesters or only 1 year. So as long as a student remains eligible through their GPA and their performance at the college, then they will have tuition and fees paid for up to six semesters. Mm. So the goal is completion and to help them on their way through their educational journey and making sure, too, that these are programs that the Promise is funding are, there's a long list of the ones that are eligible. There are financial aid eligible programs here at the college, and we know that many of them are in high demand careers. So our community is going to have a skilled workforce faster. than if students had not come to Gateway right out of high school.
Mm-hmm. And if anyone wanted to find out more about this very specific program, how would they do so?
They can find out more at gtc.edu/promise.
I'm going to give you 30 seconds, and what I'd like you to do is to formulate in your own words the message about what the foundation is in terms of if you were talking to a group of people who are interested in giving money, because, you know, all the things you've talked about that the foundation does and wants to do and wants to do in the future, it takes dollars to do so.
It does.
And these are dollars that people contribute, that corporations contribute, mm-hmm. that other foundations, that estates contribute. Mm-hmm. So what kind of message would you want to say that would give all those feelings of what the foundation is all about?
Well, I know that one of the most critical elements, of course, is that we know how vital education is for our community and for families and family-supporting jobs. And so whether your passion is education or you are looking to help individuals who want to change their lives so that they are in a family-supporting job, or that you want to support someone who wants to be a lifelong learner but doesn't have the financial capacity to really continue to grow, all of those things are made possible when people give to the foundation. And we know that our more educated workforce attracts more businesses here to our community. It helps retain businesses to our community. And so overall, it helps provide a better life for individuals and families, our neighborhoods and our cities, our townships, our villages, when individuals have had the very best in education and have had the chance to really shine using their skills and their talents.
And that is one wonderful message. Thank you. I would like to thank Dr. Jennifer Charpentier, who is the Executive Director of the Gateway Foundation here at Gateway Technical College. And Jennifer, you are welcome anytime here on Education Matters. And as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we continue now with Education Matters here on WGTD-HD. I'm very pleased to welcome Christina Samuels, Assistant Editor for Education Week. And welcome to Education Matters.
Thank you.
I always like to start with guests in terms of getting some of your own background, where you went to school, where you grew up, where you went to college, so at least our listeners have some background of who you are.
Sure. Well, I grew up in suburban Washington, D.C. in Virginia, and I attended college at Florida A&M University, where I majored in journalism. I worked at the Miami Herald. I then moved to the Washington Post, where I first started covering education. And in 2004, I moved to Education Week, where I've been covering special education and a variety of other beats, but right now, special education and early childhood education.
One of the articles that you wrote recently, it appeared online on April 19th of this year, and then it was in print in the April 20th edition of Education Week. And it really caught my eye, and the headline is that the number of U.S. students in special education is moving upward. And I thought maybe if we could talk about that, and maybe if you could just give us some background about that.
Yeah, this was a really interesting piece to do. For the last, I would say, since about 2004, which was when the last time was the special education law was reauthorized by Congress. It's called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, and it oversees, it sort of spells out all the rules the schools and districts must follow with special education. Well, since that time, there had been a pretty steady decrease in the number of students with disabilities, and there's a lot of reasons why that could be happening. There were some things written into the law that encouraged schools to use different sort of educational methods and techniques before evaluating a child with special education services. There were some other things going on in the what was then known as the No Child Left Behind Act that sort of encouraged schools and districts to perhaps keep the numbers of their special education students low. And so, you know, one would hope that perhaps these students were getting what they needed, but just outside the specific special education system. So since 2004, there had been this downswing. But then in the last couple of years, maybe 3 years or so, there has been an uptick again. And what has been interesting is that that number has been driven pretty much by an increase in the number of students with autism and an increase in the number of students who are classified as having other health impairments.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is not something that, unfortunately, the Department of Education doesn't go into further detail about what other health impairments are, but often this includes children who have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It could also include children who have mental health disorders such as bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, anxiety, depression, and then it would also include children who might have diabetes, epilepsy, other types of health, mobility impairments, other type of health impairments that they are all sort of lumped into this group. I would suspect that a large proportion of students in this category have ADHD.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, Christina, based on what you said, and I'm looking at the chart right now, and I see the increase from 2005 to 2014, the increase in autism, autistic students who are categorized for special ed is up, as you indicated, 165%. But one of the things you mentioned, and you talk about it in your article, do you think there's been a concerted effort to downtick, if you will, I'm making up this word now, to downtick the number of students in special ed, even though they get additional funding and there are other things that school districts get through IDEA and later through No Child Left Behind?
You know, that's a challenging question, and the reason I say this without trying to escape it is that there are so many school districts and so many things that go into play with what an individual school or district or state may be doing, which is a challenge in itself, right? Because, I mean, we can see that the rates of students with autism, for example, really varies a lot from state to state. Now, is it that New Jersey just happens to have more students with autism than a state like Arkansas, for example? Or are there other policy things at play that make it more possible for you to be diagnosed as having autism in New Jersey versus Arkansas? I tend to think it's the latter. I tend to think that there's a lot of policy elements that go into whether a child is diagnosed with a disability or not, or what disability category that child is placed in.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be a concern. You know, one thing that was interesting to me in reporting the story that you're referring to is when I was talking with people at the Department of Education, they said that the federal government requires that a school district diagnose a child with a disability if he or she has one. So they're not supposed to be able to duck this, although, you know, sometimes things happen. But they are not guaranteed a certain type of category. If you have autism, and for whatever reason, or if you have some symptoms of autism, but a district says, you know, this looks like emotional disturbance to us, then you don't have a right to say, actually, it looks more like autism to me. I mean, you have a right in the sense that a parent can go to due process and can, you know, challenge a certain diagnosis. So, but you can't just say like, nah, I just want to be in another category.
Mm-hmm.
So all this to say that I do think that there's a lot of policy elements at play. In some places, it could serve to perhaps depress the number of students with disabilities, because even though you're getting money from the federal government and from the state, it doesn't necessarily cover the full cost. There could be other places where, for whatever reason, there are some incentives to over-identify students with disabilities because of the funding, those different funding formulas at those states and those districts. So there are, you know, I have jokingly said to my boss before, I wish we did not have all 50 states and that all 50 of these states had so many school districts within them, because it's hard sometimes to get a feel for what is happening at the local level. There's definitely a lot that goes into play there, and I definitely would say that there are policy elements to all of this.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you pointed out you mentioned New Jersey, but in your article, and you were just using that as an example, I know, but in your article, you talk very specifically about the state of Virginia, which is not mm-hmm. too far from where you are right now in Maryland, that it's among the states that has seen a large increase in population. And you quote some comments made by John Eisenberg, who's the state director of special ed. And here's a state that in the past, at least, had a low incidence of autism, and now they've had this huge increase. Did you get any sense at all as to why? I mean, I know everyone likes to report numbers, but are there any reasons why, other than that they're being classified a little differently or there's a more concerted effort to identify them?
One thing that I could say that was happening in Virginia and probably is happening in a lot of other states is that while there has been this large increase in the number of students with autism, there has also been a decrease in the number of students with disabilities that may look like autism, which would be learning disabilities is a category under IDEA that's been going down. Emotional disabilities has also been going down. And intellectual disabilities, these are three disabilities that all have been on the downswing while autism has been on the upswing. Also, I believe and I think that research has shown that there is just actually an organic number increase in the number of kids diagnosed with autism. So there's some things going on that they call reclassification. So students who might have been put in one category being put into another, and then also perhaps students who might not have been diagnosed with any disability before. Maybe they might have been called quirky or, you know, whatever kind of, you know, sort of non-medical judgment that somebody might have made, that people are looking at this now and saying, no, this actually may be on the a form of autism. Autism is, you know, known as a spectrum disorder. So there's a lot of different ways that it manifests itself. When I was reporting that particular story, somebody suggested, and we were just sort of hypothesizing as we were talking, is that perhaps these milder forms of autism are being caught more now because people just have more of an awareness of what autism looks like mm-hmm. and the features of autism. And so certain things that weren't that might have been getting ignored or sort of glossed over in prior years may just be getting more attention now. And so that could also be driving this increase that we're seeing in that mm-hmm. particular category. Mm-hmm.
I was really fascinated by the article that you wrote May 31st, was published on June 1st, headline, "Are There Too Few Minority Students in Special Education?" I really found your article here, and you quoted some of the research of Paul Morgan and George Farkas. Maybe if you could talk a bit about this, because I think this is something that we don't hear enough about, and maybe we need to.
Yeah, this was a fascinating story to do, and I've covered this a few times in a few different stories, but this was a larger piece that I was able to kind of pull some threads together here. So since IDEA came into law in the mid-70s, there's always been a concern that minority students, and here really I'm speaking about black students, that black students and Hispanic students in some cases have been overrepresented in special education, particularly in the disabilities that are believed to carry the most stigma. So we're talking about what was then known as mental retardation, now we call it intellectual disability, and emotional disturbances. And there's been a long-running concern, and that has been backed up by research that shows that black students are represented in those categories at rates greater than their representation in the population as a whole. So, you know, if you have, you know, black students with mental retardation, there's a higher percentage of them in that category than there are just in the student body as a whole. So that's been a long-running concern, and IDEA is kind of built around trying to stop that from happening. There are elements that have been written into the law in the past couple of years that have told states and school districts, look, you need to be careful not to over-identify black students and Hispanic students and minority students as being in any category. You need to keep an eye out for this. Well, Paul Morgan and George Farkas looked at this data, and they used a data set of young students, and they tracked them over time, And they said that when you equalize students as much as possible, so you say you take a black student and a white student, and when you control for things such as poverty, such as academic performance, such as family makeup and other kinds of things, and so you make them as similar as possible, you actually see the black students are less likely to be identified for being in special education. And this is true even in those categories, those what are considered to be stigmatizing categories. So as you can imagine, this is not just like kind of a tweak of what has been accepted wisdom. This is just going against completely what has been accepted wisdom for quite some time in the field. And ever since, and they've actually come up with several studies that have said this. They've looked at different ways of analyzing the data and different disability categories. But what got the most attention was when they wrote a piece in the New York Times not too long ago that said that if there is racism in special education, it is actually that black students are not getting it as much as they need to. And as you can imagine, that has caused quite a lot of attention within the advocacy community. There's a lot of people who think that they are just outright wrong. There's a lot of people who say, well, you know, maybe they're not wrong here, but they're overstating the case. And they've come back and had a, you know, some responses to the responses, and it goes on. But it's a very interesting situation. And their argument is that maybe districts are feeling constrained from providing services to children because they fear being called racist if they place a child in special education. And their argument is that if special education is a civil right and if you are supposed to get it if you meet these certain standards, that not providing it to a child is as racist as giving it to a child who doesn't need it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely been a lot of really interesting conversation about that.
Yeah, in fact, the editorial that they wrote that appeared in the New York Times, I know that got a lot of attention. And I read the actual research paper, and one of the things that you point out is that both Morgan and Farkas, they have replicated this study a number of times and essentially get the same kinds of results. So why do they think that there's so much pushback? I know the article that was in the New York Times, that there's even a reference to the fact that there are some people in policymaking decisions who do believe that in particular African-American students are overrepresented in special education.
Yeah, I think that, you know, they would, you know, characterize the pushback as coming from people who have done other types of research that have come up with opposite findings, and their response to that is that those that research was not as statistically rigorous as the research that they have done. And so that's there. And of course, you know, nobody wants to say like, well, your research was shoddy and that's why you came up with the wrong result. So there's definitely going to be some arguments there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, what this really comes down to is I think that it touches on some very sticky subjects and very passionate subjects that people feel about race and how students are treated in school because of their race. You know, you can walk into a classroom and see a lot of black students in certain self-contained classrooms and in classrooms where for students with severe disabilities, and it just doesn't feel right. It could, you know, your feeling may be like, why are all these black students here? And what they're saying is those black students are there is because they are actually manifesting certain qualities that go along with being diagnosed with certain disabilities. That's why you see so many, but that if you kind of statistically control for the things that I mentioned earlier, they're actually underrepresented. So what they could be saying is that as many as you think you're seeing, you really should be seeing more.
Mm-hmm.
That worries people. I think that it also speaks a lot to what we think about special education, to be honest. Special education should not be considered something that is good or bad. It's value neutral. It's a set of services that come with being diagnosed with a certain set of disabilities. Nevertheless, It's considered in many places to be a lesser education. You're less likely to graduate. You're less likely to have opportunities to do certain, be involved in certain activities of the school. You're more likely to drop out. There's a lot of sort of negative consequences, unfortunately, that go with being enrolled in special education. And so if someone were to say, well, actually, we think that more black kids deserve to be here, that is going to feel not good to a lot of observers who would question the value of special education. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a big underlying piece of this debate as well. So, yeah, it is definitely an interesting story. And I will say, you know, just to add something to the people who have said that this doesn't match with their own research, is that this comes from big national data sets. And much as I was saying that special education plays out differently from place to place, some people have said, well, sure, you know, this plays out differently in different areas. There are some states, some school districts, some areas, some parts of the country where overrepresentation may be more of a problem than in other parts of the country. That data that Morgan and Farkas looked at, I don't believe gets into geographic distinctions mm-hmm. like that.
Somewhat related to what you were just saying, the whole aspect of special education, and maybe if we can maybe shift to the fact that that there's a need for more special education teachers. And in an article that you wrote back at the end of January of this year, you talked about that. And one of the quotes from Mary Brownell, who is a professor at my former alma mater, the University of Florida, said that one of the reasons why, at least with her research, that shows that there are teachers who go into teacher education who choose not to go into special ed is because oftentimes they have to teach more subjects. But as you look at the big picture and you look at the fact that there's a real need for more special education teachers, in putting together that article, what did you come away with as far as what you see teacher education across the country trying to do to attract more future teachers into special ed?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things that I learned about was universities that are trying to work with students, even in high school, to get them interested in working with their peers with disabilities, with the thinking that if they go into teaching, then they will be more interested in continuing to work with other with young people with disabilities. I think that there's a lot of people who go into special education because they had that background, that specific experience that really just sort of charged them up and just said, like, yeah, you know, this is something that I think I can do, and this is something that I want to do. I thought that was really fascinating, is the idea that you could start even before young people become teachers, even if they're just thinking about it, and get them involved in some of these peer counseling type of activities mm-hmm. and get them interested in that. But I think that one of the things that, you know, people have to think about is universities prepare teachers, of course. And then once that teacher is placed in a school, that is really what I believe makes a big difference about who's going to stay in special education and who is going to just see it as something overwhelming or something that they don't want to continue. I think that school experience and how that teacher is integrated into the life of the school, how that teacher partners with other teachers, because special education teachers are very often asked to work in partnership with general education teachers, and sometimes general education teachers aren't wanting to do that so much. You know, a lot of these things play a big role in how successful a special education teacher is going to be once they leave college.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you for taking your time, Christina, to talk about special education, because certainly that's a very important area. My last question for you is, what are you working on right now, and what might we expect in a upcoming article in Education Week? And for our listeners, if you're interested in following what's happening in education, in particular what Christina Samuels writes, you can go to edweek.org, and you can at least see some of the articles on there. But what are you working on right now?
Yeah, well, I'm working on an interesting story about what happens if you accept a voucher or some other kind of school choice mechanism. Education savings accounts are very popular right now. What happens to your IDEA rights if you place your child in a private school with a state-funded voucher? And, you know, I'm finding that there's been some studies that have looked at this recently, and I found some parents to talk about what their experience has been. And it's interesting. It's a challenging situation for parents often to say that they're going to leave the public school system and go the private route. But a lot of parents choose to do this because they feel that ultimately that's making a better choice for them and their families. And I think that there's a lot of vouchers out there that actually are aimed directly at parents of students with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And so I'm exploring that for a story that hopefully will be coming out real soon.
Good. Well, I look forward to reading that. And again, I want to thank you for taking your time. And as always, I look forward to reading your articles in Education Week.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
And my guests this morning on Education Matters have been Jennifer Charpentier, who is the executive director of the Gateway Foundation here at Gateway Technical College, and Christina Samuels, who's the education